Hello everyone, this is Thomas Rickert speaking. Can we get the recording started, please?
Recordings have started.
Thanks very much. Hello everyone, this is Thomas Rickert speaking, the GNFO appointed co-chair to the CCWG, and I would like to welcome all of you to this 10th plenary call of the CCWG in Workstream 2. And as usual, I'd like to ask whether there are any updates to statements of interest. I don't see any hands. And as usual, staff is more than happy to help you updating your statements of interest or even to help you prepare one should you have not filed yours so far. And let me also take this opportunity that it is important for you to file a statement of interest, particularly in this very group dealing with accountability. You may know that it's no issue whatsoever to have an interest, but there should be transparency in terms of what your interests are. Let's now do the roll call, and we would like to take the roll call from the remote participation room. So can I ask whether there are any participants who are only in the only on audio and not in the AC room? And we will move to Farzani afterwards because she does have a statement of an update to her statement of interest. But let's complete the roll call first. So is there anyone on the audio bridge only?
This is Greg Shatton.
Yeah.
I'm on audio for the moment.
Hi, Marcus Kummer here on the audio.
Okay, so we have Greg Shatton, Marcus
Kummer. Yeah, on audio as well.
So there was some crosstalk. Who was that? Sean?
Or JDG, yeah.
Okay. Welcome, Sean. And
not sure you got me. Thomas Marcus here on audio as well.
Yes. Thanks very much, Marcus. We will add you to the list. And Barack Otieno is also on the phone. And thanks, Cavus, for reminding me that I should speak slowly. I hope that this is slowly enough so that I can sufficiently be understood. And Farzi, the floor is yours to speak to your update to your statement of interest.
Hi, thanks, Thomas. So I just wanted to say that I have changed affiliation and I have finished my PhD at Hamburg University and I have joined the Internet Governance Project at Georgia Tech. And I'm going to start in January the position, so I have not yet changed the affiliation on the SOI, but I will do that as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Farzi, and let me join those congratulating you in the chat with going on record to congratulate you on this. So that's great news. Anyone else? Okay, so that leaves me with reminding everyone to abide by the expected standards of behavior as recently updated and published by ICANN. So with that, we can move to the next agenda item, and that agenda item is going to be chaired by my colleague Mathieu.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Mathieu Vey speaking, the CCNSO appointed co-chair. This second agenda item, and probably we should go through the slides so you can see the relevant items. Yes, let's stay on the timeline for a first reminder that we are counting, I think, 9 weeks before the ICANN Copenhagen meeting documents can be submitted, and that's essentially that especially important for the two subgroups which are on the track two, also named the fast track, staff accountability and the good faith conduct guidelines, because if we want the public comments to be closed in time for our review in Copenhagen, we need to issue this comment on January the 18th. So this is a reminder that we are working on actually a quite narrow and schedule, and I'm noting Avery's point in the chat that it's doubtful that staff accountability is going to make that schedule. I fully understand that, given that we haven't received everything back. So this is just a key milestone we need to have in mind, obviously not putting any pressure or anything on anyone to deliver, but it's the kind of milestone we need to have in mind when working our way through the various steps in the subgroups. The next reminder is on the next slide that we have a public consultation ongoing regarding the let's move to the next slide. The ongoing consultation is regarding the IRP supplementary rules. Can we have the next slide, please? At this point, there are four comments from three participants, and the closing date is on January the 10th. So this is a reminder that we to liaise with your respective groups and encourage everyone to weigh in if there's anything in the supplementary rules that needs to be supported. Support can be expressed or commented on. Obviously, this is the point of public comments. Next item on our list is it was a follow-up from Hyderabad, where we had agreed that a letter regarding the accountability and transparency review team number 3 would be sent to the ASO NAC chairs. This letter has been forwarded to the leaders of each of the supporting organization and advisory committees. The recommendation was to have an HERT3 with a narrow scope. It's now in the hands of the leaders of the ASO and ACs to discuss with the board how to organize this in the future. So that's a completed action and a discussion that may take place in your respective groups in the coming weeks or months, hopefully. So that's for the admin item, but one, which is probably the most important. So on the next slide is a reminder of the application process we've agreed to for the funding to attend ICANN 58. And I have received notice from Bernie that there was a small issue with this process. Bernie, could you maybe update the group directly?
Yes, thank you. Hi, there was a miscommunication between ICANN Travel and ourselves relative to the timing, and they're expecting there are recommendations this week, which obviously we can't do. As such, given the applications have all but stopped, I would propose that we leave the applications open until the proposed time, but that we do a first batch as of Monday. And the reason for that is that there are quite a few applications that are for partial funding. And if we don't provide the okay for those, we will be slowing down the process for everyone else's, for those people's travel funding to Copenhagen. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernie. So I see Alan's hands up. Alan, a question maybe?
Thank you. I think what you just said, what Bernie just said, is the ones who requested partial funding, that is a single day, you will do the work earlier. Can we have a specific date when you will have the answers? Some of us have critical issues that have to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. My understanding was early next week. Yes, Bernie, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. Thank you.
You're not willing to commit to more than early next week, though?
No, because obviously we haven't studied anything. So is there a more specific deadline that would make a difference between Tuesday next week and Wednesday next week, Alan?
I don't know. It just makes lives difficult for some people who are trying to make other arrangements at the same time. Thank you.
I fully understand that, and as Bernie said, there was a misunderstanding at basis, and that's why we're sort of rearranging our plans, because we know there are dependencies on your side. So we're well aware that the shorter the turnaround and the response time on the requests, the better. So we'll do our best on that. Cavus?
Yes. Two small questions. After a good day to all, good time to everyone. It is mentioned from 11 to 17. That includes the one-day face-to-face CCWG, or that excludes that? This is question one. Question two, I applied for the full-time, but I was told that no, this time rules have been changed, and only maybe one day or maybe two nights and one day, that's all. So I just want to be sure that this time no one asked for a full period of 7 or 8 days, only one day, two nights, and so on and so forth. I want to be sure not to have any discrimination between the people, because my first application was commented that please change that one day or two nights and so on and so forth, and I did that. But I don't want to be this advantage with respect to the others. This is the question I want to be sure. First, disability is included in this 11 to 17 or excluded? And second, this one day or two nights is maximum for everyone, but not any exceptions. Thank you.
Thank you, Cavus. Bernie, what is the exact date for our meeting? Isn't it on the 10th, on the day before the regular meeting?
We've applied for the standard day before it starts, which is the 10th of March. And the rules, as you're aware, we've advised everyone exactly the same way, that we will be funding a maximum of one airfare and 2 days as the maximum.
Thank you, Bernie. So despite what's on the slide, the accountability meeting is on the 10th, and the criteria will be the same for everyone with the same process. And we've been clear from the start when we discussed the budget cost control mechanisms that it's mostly focused on funding for the day of the meeting, of course, with a couple of nights around this. Except under exceptional circumstances. So that's going to be our approach for that. Any other questions? I see a few comments in the chat regarding the comparison with Hyderabad. I think what happened in Hyderabad was that there was a decision later on in the process, once we had all the requests, to extend a number of the fundings, but that was not, and that was because we had a very limited number of requests. Am I correct, Bernie?
We were just starting off on our process, and essentially, yes, that is correct. Thank you.
Good. Avery, please.
Okay, quick question. So people still have until the 8th to figure out whether they're going to be able to go even with this assistance. And but it's kind of like a first come, first serve, that even though the application window is open until 8 January, you're going to be deciding on the applications as they come in a first come, first serve sort of process, or did I misunderstand?
Good question, Avery. I think given the number of requests we've received so far, which is significantly below our maximum number, we think we're not precluding too much about the ability of those who would not be in a position to apply until January the 8th. So it's still possible to wait until January the 8th to submit, and we don't think it's going to create any inefficiencies. It's a sort of a two-batch treatment, which is obviously not optimal, but as we said, we have had a miscommunication at the start, so we're sort of managing the least of two evils here. So if we had too many requests in this first batch, we would have to say, look, warning, we're not sure, because we're still giving everyone until January the 8th. I see Avery saying that she thinks she understands now. That's as good as it can get. So thank you very much for your understanding. It's a small change in the process, but hopefully it's going to work out all right. So we now move to the next agenda item with an update from the legal committee, and I'm turning to Leon.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Leon Sanchez. And if we could please turn to the slide on the legal committee. We have a review of the requests, and the only outstanding request that we had until yesterday were the questions from the human rights subgroup, which we received a reply from ICANN Legal yesterday at night on my side of the world, which would be somewhere around very early UTC today. And these replies have been forwarded both to the legal committee for review and the incumbent subgroup in parallel, so we are able to assess the replies from ICANN Legal and determine whether those are appropriate and if there should be any need for external advice on this issue. And other than that, there are no outstanding requests. And we had a question on the process for requests from the IRP IOT. And we do have, we did have a discussion on this in our prep call with the chairs and the rapporteurs from the different subgroups. And the question stood on whether the legal request coming from the IRP IOT should need to follow the same process as those questions being raised by other subgroups. By this I mean going through the legal committee, or since there is a specific bylaw that enables the IRP IOT to request legal advice directly, should this fall out of the legal committee's remit or scope. So there was questions that David McCauley sent to Sam Eisner, and I would like to handle the floor to David so he can walk us through this conversation. David?
Leon, thank you. David McCauley here. And I will note that I recently took over as the rapporteur for the IRP implementation oversight team when Becky Burr formally became a member of the board. And we had our first instance of seeking outside legal advice in the past couple of weeks to clarify or ascertain the legal implications of an issue that we were discussing among ourselves. It's ancillary to the pending rules, but it is an important question for the group as we move forward. And I wrote to the co-chairs of the CCWG and accountability just to confirm my understanding that the IRP-IoT team could move forward with legal questions separately from sending them to the legal group. And I was coming from the position that the bylaws with respect to the IRP process, that's bylaw 4.3, actually specifically says at 4.3N small IB, N4, I'm sorry, N1, NI, that upon request, this is what the verbiage is, upon request, the IRP implementation oversight team shall have assistance of counsel and other appropriate experts. And so it was on that basis that I was posing that question or request for clarification. And in the prep call, we decided that we would that I would forward the question to Sam and have a discussion with Sam about this. And I'm in contact with Sam separately on IRP matters periodically. And in her reply to me, Sam noted that there's nothing that requires the IoT work to be treated like Workstream 2 as far as accrual of legal expenses go. And so it's in that vein that we can go directly for legal help, but the process that we're going to follow is I will keep Sam in the loop as we do this from time to time because the PCST, and I forgot the acronym, but I think it's the Project Cost Steering Team or something like that. It's the group that's looking at legal expenses. Actually does report on the budget spend for implementation oversight teamwork. So that's my understanding is that from now on we will go directly to outside counsel in conjunction with keeping Sam in the loop. And, of course, I'll keep the CCWG co-chairs in the loop as well. So that, Leon, is my understanding right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David, for this. And yes, that is my understanding too. And the reason for this is that, as you stated, while the PCST is reporting on the expenses of the IRP IoT, it does not directly impact Workstream 2 budget, as far as I understand, and therefore the IRP IoT would be able to directly access legal advisors as you have described. And I see a couple of hands up. I see Abby's hand up, and then I have Malcolm Hardy. Abby, you have the floor. Okay, I think that was an all hand. So then we'll go to Malcolm. Malcolm, you have the floor.
Thank you. I've got no interest in which budget this comes out of, but I would like to check clarification that this change of procedure or that this different procedure doesn't impact the which advice, whose advice it is that we're seeking. The IoT is responsible to the CCWG, and the IoT needs the independent advice on what it's proposing because it needs to understand what it is proposing. So I just wanted to check that saying that this would be dealt with through an alternative route doesn't mean that we're going to lose the benefit of Holly and Rosemary's advice and instead be reliant on ICANN's in-house and external counsel because obviously it's extreme. I mean, apart from anything else, there's all the reasons apply as to why we wanted external counsel to the IoT and apply actually even stronger because ICANN is particularly conflicted in this matter. So can you please confirm that this will be passing this directly to Holly and Rosemary and not through ICANN Legal and out to Jones Day? Thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm. I can confirm you that after the conversation and the discussion that we held, the IRP IoT will not lose the benefit of Holly and Rosemary advising directly to the IRP team. And you will continue to have direct access to these kind of external legal advice. Is that
thank you.
Does that answer your question?
That does, and very satisfactorily. Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. Okay, so seeing no other comments on this issue, We have, of course, the wiki where we keep track of the requests. The link is on the slide. And since we have received the human rights replies just a few hours ago, I would kindly ask staff to update the wiki correspondingly and to reflect that we have received the replies on the human rights questions by ICANN Legal. So, seeing no comments or questions to the report on the legal committee, I would now turn to Michael J. Thomas for our next agenda item. Thomas?
Sorry, Leon, it took me a while to unmute. Let's now move to the next agenda item, and that's a series of updates on sub-teams. But before we go to sub-teams, let's first hear a little update on the IGF. And that's kindly going to be delivered by Steve Del Bianco. So, Steve, the floor is yours. I suggest that after your intervention, we will open it up for colleagues in this group to ask questions.
Thank you, Thomas. It's Steve Del Bianco with the Business Constituency. There are many on this call who were present at the Internet Governance Forum in Guadalajara last week, and I'm sure they'd agree that it was a uniquely pleasant place to have a meeting. I've already recommended to ICANN board and to Nick Tomasa that they consider Guadalajara. Perfect climate, fantastic food, and not so expensive. So it was a great meeting. Yeah, I'll say just a few things with respect to the work of this group and how it was referenced at the IGF. There were four sessions on the calendar explicitly about or sponsored by ICANN, including one about, quote, a post-transition ICANN. There were several other sessions that included discussions about ICANN, and I would summarize the outputs in three ways. First, the work of the CCWG and CWG were discussed and admired as examples of the multi-stakeholder process working well. For those of us that endured the two-year process, that may not have been as obvious to us, but more for the breadth of participation and the remarkable nature of what we accomplished, I can tell you that many at the IGF, civil society and governments that didn't participate at ICANN were very much in admiration and would cite that process within ICANN as the multi-stakeholder model at work. The second is that, in particular, some governments were grateful and frankly amazed that the U.S. government actually allowed the IANA contract to expire at the end of September. There were many who thought that wouldn't have happened. And as someone who works in Washington, I can tell you there were moments I wasn't sure what happened either. And the third was interest in participating on aspects of ICANN, but being fearful about how to enter the process, since our acronym soup can be daunting. I took an opportunity at a couple of panels to invite participation in some of the Workstream 2 projects that align with the themes that the IGF works on. And in particular, those were SOAC accountability. In fact, there was a dynamic coalition on accountability of multi-stakeholder groups. There was a session on human rights, a whole theme on human rights at IGF. So I encouraged participation in the human rights work stream too. Jurisdiction and diversity. And I explained that work stream 2 has a somewhat limited time frame. It may extend another several months to a year, but I also explained that these groups were open to all. They're relatively bite-sized parts of the ICANN policy world, and I said that they're vitally important and carry with them a greater obligation for the ICANN board and management to implement consensus recommendations that emerge from the Workstream 2 tracks, more so than the recommendations of an ordinary review team and other kind of processes. So the Workstream 2 is important, very relevant to the work of the IGF, and I think there's a chance we'll see a few extra participants in SOAC accountability, HR, jurisdiction, and diversity. So, Thomas, that's all I had. I'm sure that there are others who were present who may want to add more. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. I guess that's excellent news for those who haven't been there to witness the discussions on site. So for those who want to add to that or comment or support Steve's views or maybe challenge them that they got a different impression, please make sure that you make yourself heard. And while you're considering to speak, let me thank Avery also for explaining our work and promoting our work and participation in the fora that she was in civil society. So I guess this is excellent, and it's good that you and others in our group go out as ambassadors and try to advocate for participation in this important piece of work. And it's not only important, it's not only interesting, but we're having so much fun, don't we? During all day and night times that we
True enough.
Had our discussions.
True enough.
So it looks like, Steve, this is considered by everyone as a fair representation of what happened in Guadalajara. So let me thank you for giving this quick update. And again, I guess this positive feedback, again, is something that all of you should be very proud of, because the accomplishment of this group is outstanding and unprecedented. So thanks again. And let's now move to the next topic on our agenda. And I think that's going to be chaired by Mathieu.
That's correct, Thomas. This is Mathieu Vey speaking. A short update from the Ombuds Office subgroup. And you will remember in Hyderabad we had discussed about the upcoming external review for the Ombuds function or office. And Sebastian is going to report about the progress since then. Quite briefly, obviously, it's for your information, but I think it's valuable for everyone to know. Sebastian?
Thank you, Mathieu. I will try to be as brief as possible. Then, yes, external review of the ICANN Ombuds Office is now underway. We have discussed with input from ICANN Legal about a possibility for the ombudsman and his predecessor to be participants still in this group, even if we are handling the review, and if they are willing, they can, and we are very happy with this answer. Specific budget was allocated. Outside expert will be chosen, and then we'll be able to review the ICANN office ombuds and, of course, bring his or her expertise to the drafting team to a report of the drafting team. We are currently working on the planning. It's not very easy to add to our current planning the full review with time for comments, public comment period. Therefore, I don't know if we will be able to meet the deadline even for the second possibilities that mean for the South African meeting, but we will try. And we are also reviewing what will be the role of the ICANN office ombuds drafting team in that process. And we are currently setting a small team to be more agile with a call for proposal or request for proposal for the external review. Next slide, please. And we are also thinking about what we need to delay after receiving the external review report and what we can handle in parallel. And I think that it's important that we keep all the link with the other drafting teams to be sure that we answer when they need. And I saw a lot of some comments about what the ombuds can do for the transparency team, and we will work on that quickly. And we also participate to the SOIC accountability to see how the ombuds can be included in the work of this sub-team. Thank you very much, and ready to answer any question if you have any.
Thank you, Sébastien. It's important that we have this in mind. Any questions for Sébastien or for the Ombuds group? I'm seeing none, and this was meant to be a short update. Maybe we can move to the next update, thanking Sébastien again for conciseness and efficiency. And the next item is SOEC accountability, and I think it's back to Thomas.
That is correct, and let me immediately hand over to the SOAC accountability rapporteurs to give us a quick update on where they are.
Hearing none, this is Steve Del Bianco. My co-rapporteurs are Farzan Ebadi and Cheryl Langdonor for SOAC accountability. And we've made some serious progress. We have three tracks in our actual deliverables, and the first track is the one that is waiting on the receipt of the responses to the questionnaires that we circulated to all of the SOs, ACs, stakeholder groups, and constituencies. And we've received several, but there are still several outstanding. We're a bit past the requested deadline, and we would respectfully ask that if any on this call are aware of groups that are working on their responses, to just send the co-chairs an email giving us some expectation when you think you might be able to deliver. So our first track will be to review and assess those, and we may even come back to SOs and ACs with further questions as we dive into the document references they provide. Tracks 2 and 3, we actually have preliminary conclusions. I won't get into the details on this call, but we'll have a second reading on our preliminary conclusions on tracks 2 and 3 on our group call tomorrow. I think that is a fair summary of where we are right now, and I think that that's an accurate reflection of our progress at 40%. I think that's all I have on that, Thomas. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. And I see that Cavus' hand is up, so Cavus, please take the floor.
Yes, thanks for the report. Just the deadline for reply, if I'm not mistaken, was 1 month from the release of the request. So this 1 month has expired, so I would be most appreciative if someone says that how many replies from the 6 charging organizations has been received, and whether the deadline will be closed at some time. And the next important question, how they are going to review the replies and analyze the replies. This for information of the entire CCWG. I know you may discuss that at the level of the group, but still it's good that CCWG knows that how this supply would be analyzed and how it will be used. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. I guess these are excellent points. So, Steve, I guess the questions are clear. One, how do we make sure to get responses from our groups? And two, how is the feedback being analyzed?
Thank you. Steve Del Bianco here. There are more than just the SONAC groups, because remember that constituency and stakeholder groups within, in particular within GNSO, have individual charters and individual accountability processes. So we're going to get more, and those have begun coming in as well. So, Cavus, we will catalog on tomorrow's call who is still outstanding and do active outreach to request them to complete it as soon as possible. There are only a few that are outstanding. The second thing you asked about was what methodology will our subgroup use to analyze the responses. And, Cruz, as you know, that's something our subgroup will define. And we have an entire sub-team, sub-team number one, that was allocated to that task. So we'll discuss that on tomorrow's telephone call for the SOAC accountability group. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Steve. I don't see any further hands raised. And that leaves me with the pleasure to thank you and your co-rapporteurs for the work so far. And I'd like to hand over to Leon for the next sub-team.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Leon Sanchez again. And we have a shorter update and some questions for the plenary by the diversity group. And for that, I would like to handle the floor to Rafiq. Rafiq, you have the floor.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Rafiq.
Okay. Okay, thanks. So it's really a short update after a while. So we are working within subgroup with the strawman to elicit input from the subgroup members and trying to clarify about elements of diversity. So we are continuing to work with that document and trying to finalize in the coming weeks. In terms of the question, I don't have a question to provide yet, but one idea we had is to work or draft a questionnaire that we would like to share with the ESO and ACs to share with them the element of diversity they consider important, and to get their feedback on that matter. On the other hand, one topic that we were discussing within the subgroup, it's about the data collection regarding the diversity, and we are trying to identify who to contact and where to get this information. So those are the area that we are focusing for now. And so hopefully we'll make some progress by next week.
Thank you very much, Rafiq. And, the diversity group took a little bit longer than other subgroups to take off. I think that you have done very good progress, and I thank you as well for your work. And I now would like to turn back to my co-chair, Matthew, for jurisdiction subgroup. Matthew?
Thank you very much, Leon. Matthew Wei speaking. So this jurisdiction subgroup, there's been a lot of work in this subgroup. So it's not only an update, but also a first consideration of a list of questions. But I will turn to Greg or Vinay, probably Greg Shatton, for an introduction and the questions you want to raise with the plenary, Greg.
Thank you, Matthew. Greg Shatton, for the record. You see before you and also in your email earlier today, or late yesterday, depending upon where you are, questions that have been proposed within the jurisdiction subgroup for consideration to send out or to post and publicize on an ICANN website. Questions in order to aid the analysis of the other jurisdiction subgroup of its remit. So the initial idea that was floated just after Hyderabad was that we were light on knowledge of actual experiences of community members and others who have dealt with issues where ICANN's jurisdiction has come into play, and we're trying to move from the hypothetical to the actual and get some what one might call anecdotal evidence of the of past or current situations that those who have been involved could share with the subgroup. over the course of time. Another question was introduced, which it asks more broadly for essentially what I call fact-based opinions with regard to ICANN jurisdictional question. And the group has been discussing how to whether to send any or all of these questions out or some of these questions. Following the precedent left by the accountability subgroup, we're seeking the approval of the plenary for the questions below. We're seeking the consideration of the plenary of these questions below, perhaps as well as the preamble. Since this is an approval-related concept, it does require a reading, and so I will read first the preamble, and we'll be seeking comment from the plenary on everything here. I'll note that the preamble has been generally supported by members of the subgroup without any objection noted. We did take a poll with regard to the questions to get the temperature of the room, so to speak, which we'll discuss shortly. We did not take a poll on the preamble, which was discussed on the last couple of calls, have not had any significant objection, or really any objection noted. So the proposed preamble is, the newly adopted ICANN bylaws create several Work-Stricken 2 accountability subgroups. One of them, the subgroup on jurisdiction, is posing the questions below for community input into the subgroup's deliberations. As directed by Bylaw Article 27, Section 27.1b6, and to the extent set forth in the CCWG accountability final report, the jurisdiction subgroup is addressing jurisdiction-related questions, including how choice of jurisdiction and applicable laws for dispute settlement impact ICANN's accountability. As further background, the CCWG accountability tasked this subgroup with addressing questions focused on jurisdiction of contract and dispute settlements. Final report, paragraph 6. Specifically, it asked the subgroup to engage in, quote, addressing jurisdiction-related questions, namely, can ICANN's accountability be enhanced depending on the laws applicable to its actions? The CCWG accountability anticipates focusing on the question of applicable law for contracts and dispute settlements. Final report, paragraph 234. The subgroup's remit is more particularly described in final report, Annex 12, paragraphs 25 through 31. With help of the subgroup, in these endeavors, we are asking you to consider and respond to the following specific question. In this regard, the subgroup is asking for concrete factual submissions, positive, negative, or neutral, that will help ensure that the subgroup's deliberations are informed, fact-based, and address real issues. The subgroup is interested in all types of jurisdiction-related factual experiences, not just those involving actual disputes and court cases. I'll pause here and see if there are any questions, comments, concerns, or other interventions regarding the preamble.
That's good. Thank you very much, Greg. I think so it's important that everyone understands the intent behind these questions. It's clearly laid out in this preamble. But if there's any question on this or comment, I'm seeing none so far. I'm seeing one from Kavus. Kavus.
Yes, it's, firstly, thanks, Greg. While in reply, my latest reply, I do not have any major problem to release these questions, purely and merely for gathering information. I have serious doubt on how to use the answers, as well as whether or not those answering would
be representative of the global market stakeholder community, or they will only be representative of a very limited society from few countries, which is not market stakeholder community global. In view of this, received must be cautiously considered. If they are not representative of the global market stakeholders, they will not be used to further process. So it is very important, and I see that the participation in the group is very, very limited with some people. There are people attending very forcefully and in all meetings. There are no others, so it is very difficult to answer whether it is valid, the answer, or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus, for outlining the importance of engagement when trying to reach out and get
feedback. Hello, this is Shil.
Feedback.
I'd like to stand in queue.
Sure, sir. I'll go to you after that. I think it's what I take away from your comment, Kavus, is we need to make sure that the responses we received are taken into consideration and with great care about not pretending representativeness if there's none, but I think that's the issue with many public comments and calls for input, so we probably have some experience on that. Sean, you're next.
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. This is Sean for the record. Just a question to Greg. I just wanted to get clarification. Can you confirm if indeed, based on what you've read as the goal of the group, whether the question about the jurisdiction where the organization is incorporated is open for discussion within your subgroup, and whether it's going to be part of your outcome? Because I've heard quite a lot of things, and I'd like to get clarification from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Shen. Maybe that's a hint that we should move to the various questions, Greg?
I think so. Let me just briefly respond to Shen that the answer that was given in the plenary meeting in Hyderabad was well stated. At least I think it was. I've seen it reported out, I think, by the Center for Internet and Democracy, one of the Indian-based centers. I can't remember who. It may have been Jyoti Pandey, wrote a good summary of our of the meeting, which accurately summarized the concept. We can turn to that later. And I would just briefly responding to Caboose, note that out of our members, about two-thirds are non-U.S., which is the what I take the implied concern, and that generally on our calls, we run a slight majority non-U.S. In terms of participation. So while nothing is perfect, I think in the ICANN sphere, it's not bad. And certainly, as Megan Richards notes, outreach is important. But I would say that in terms of representativeness, since we're looking for anecdotal evidence, fact-based experience, evidence that will come from, if there are more experiences from people in a certain region, then we'll probably have more reports from that region. But in any case, we're looking for individual answers. So I think trying to map this in any kind of way, I think, is perhaps not an approach that really benefits us greatly. And thank you, Vidushi. Center for Internet and Society was the name of that, and I saw it recently on the internet. So turning to the proposed question. Number one, has your business, your privacy, or your ability to use or purchase DNS-related services been affected by ICANN's jurisdiction in any way? If the answer is yes, please describe specific cases, situations, or incidents, including the date, the parties involved, and links to any relevant documents. Please note that quote-unquote affected may refer to positive and or negative effects. There's a footnote to ICANN's jurisdiction. This footnote carries through each of the questions. For these questions, ICANN's jurisdiction, quote-unquote, refers to A, ICANN being subject to U.S. and California law as a result of its incorporation and location in California. B, ICANN being subject to the laws of any other country as a result of its location within or contacts with that country. Or C, any choice of law or venue provisions in agreements with ICANN. I'll pause there for comments.
Greg, I would suggest we display the full set of questions because the intent here in a plenary is not necessary to go line by line, but to have the broader view and make sure our group is in agreement with the general direction we're taking. So maybe we can go through the various. Sean, is that something that needs clarification right now? Because I was suggesting that Greg goes through all the questions and then we get back to your comments. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Greg, are you okay with this?
Yes, I agree, and I'll proceed. And then we can deal with the comments and any comments in chat as well, as I see that's starting as well. Number two. Has ICANN's jurisdiction affected any dispute resolution process or litigation related to domain names you have been involved in? If the answer is yes, please describe specific cases, situations, or incidents, including the date, the parties involved, and links to any relevant documents. Please note that affected may refer to positive and or negative effects. Question three. Do you have copies of and or links to any verifiable reports of experiences of other parties that would be responsive to the questions above? If the answer is yes, please provide these copies and or links. Question four. What are the advantages or disadvantages, if any, relating to ICANN's jurisdiction, particularly with regard to the actual operation of ICANN's policies and accountability mechanisms? Please support your response with appropriate examples, references to specific laws, case studies, other studies, and analysis. In particular, please indicate if there are current or past instances that highlight such advantages or problems. In terms of likely future risk, please mention specific ways in which U.S. or California laws safeguard or interfere with, or may be used to safeguard or interfere with, ICANN's ability to carry out its policies throughout the world. For any disadvantage identified, please identify alternatives, including other jurisdictions, if any, where that problem would not occur. For each such jurisdiction or other alternative, please specify whether and how it would support the outcomes of CCWG accountability workstream 1. Identify the risks of those jurisdictions or other alternatives, and discuss the risks associated with changing from the current situation. That concludes the questions.
Thank you very much, Greg. There was a question in the chat by Chris Despain, which I think we should take first because it might be an overarching one, which is, could you clarify who we are intending to ask these questions to? What's the target group?
The target group is generally the broadest possible. The intent would be to post these on a web page that would be publicly accessible, and then to publicize this through usual ICANN channels for publicizing such things. Although it's not a formal public comment, therefore, you know, may or may not be appropriate to post on the public comment page, but I'll note that ICANN has about 7 or 8 different ways in which it asks for comments on different things, only one of which appears on the public comment page. So the idea would be to do hopefully some reasonable outreach, understanding that we're under some time pressure, but would ask for outreach. So we're looking for basically anyone, since it's, are looking for fact-based scenarios, hopeful we reach in particular those who've had actual interactions either with ICANN or with third parties where ICANN's jurisdiction has come into play.
Okay, so I think Chris Despain's comment is that we should then make ICANN's role clearer because there might be some misunderstanding about it. So I think it's a good comment we should take on board for before the second reading on this. Sean, you requested to be in the line, and then I move to the queue in the AC room. Sean.
Yeah, this is Sean for the record. I'd like to repose my question, which I think Greg can answer, because I wasn't asking about diversity within the group. I was specifically asking about whether ICANN change of jurisdiction is one of the things that could be an outcome from the subgroup. That is it open for discussion within your subgroup? Yes, it's actually a yes or no question, response that I required. Thank you.
Craig, can you respond by yes or no?
It's not quite a yes or no. The answer is potentially yes. Methodology of the group is to identify issues and then to identify potential remedies. We're still really in the issue identification stage of our work. If an issue is identified for which a change of jurisdiction, by which I assume one means changing the physical location and incorporation of ICANN, since jurisdiction has a number of different meanings here. If there is an issue for which that remedy would be possibly considered, then at that point we would look at that remedy, and we would look at, as question four notes, the issues that would be raised in such change and the negatives of any such change, as well as any positives. So the concept, and on the other hand, if we did not identify any issue for which that was a needed remedy, then it would not be discussed, just as any other remedy that was not suggested by any issue would also not be discussed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If the next question,
follow up.
Sean, we have quite a long line, so...
Okay, just a quick one. I hope I'm going to do a mail to the list just to maximize the time, and I hope Greg will be available to respond. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much for your understanding. Kavush, you're next. You have a question on the first question.
Yes, the first question. I don't think that even though the whole world these days is turning around the business and businessman, I don't think that we should put your business and your privacy. We should simply say, has your ability to use or purchase DNS deleting business and privacy? Because there are many other things, and we should not be selected in particular, not talking about business. We are not businessmen. There are others, but we are not businessmen all. Thank you. I am not in favor of putting business, your and your privacy. Has your ability to use or purchase DNS very general and sufficient to reply? Thank you.
Thank you. I think that can probably be dealt with. Maybe I would mix it with Jeff Newman's comment in the chat, who was asking what a DNS-related service was referring to. And maybe Greg, if you want to comment about how to tackle those two comments questions at the same time, is it something the group can try and work on?
Sure. Let me address both of those briefly. First, since the phrasing of this is an or
based list. These are alternatives. So essentially, we're asking three questions. To pick them apart, it would be, has your business been affected by ICANN's jurisdiction in any way? Has your privacy been affected by ICANN's jurisdiction in any way? Has your ability to use or purchase DNS-related services been affected by ICANN's jurisdiction in any way? In my personal view, I think all three questions are relevant. If there are additional questions, perhaps, or that could be added to that list, that would make sense. But I think deleting questions, perhaps, and not asking about business, I think would be unfortunate, especially since many disputes do involve business. But for non-business disputes, although really question two asks about disputes, but if there are, it's kind of in essence a non-commercial analog to the first item, we could add that. With regard to DNS, I think DNS here is being used in its colloquial sense. Not meaning DNS services such as managed DNS, just broadly referring to the domain name system in all of its possible facets. If there is a better kind of phrasing, certainly to consider that, it could be domain name related services rather than DNS related services. And certainly, in essence, the more you get to people who actually do understand ICANN and the DNS, the more they might actually misunderstand the phrasing DNS related services. We might confuse those who otherwise would be able to answer with the most clarity. So I think that's a fair criticism of that terminology. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. Last question, David, and then we'll conclude because we have other key topics to discuss later. David.
Matthew, thank you. It's David McCauley. When you say question, actually, I was going to make a comment on this that's consistent with what I've said in the jurisdiction group. So if this is not the time for comment, then I better not weigh in.
No, comments are welcome as well.
Okay, thank you, Matthew. I just will repeat something I've said in the jurisdiction group. It's not a criticism. I think our co-chairs have handled this matter, putting this together exceptionally well, and the participation within the group has all been fair. I just think it's a mistaken effort, and the reason I think that principally is that I believe in Workstream 2, our focus should be, excuse me, as paragraph 234 said, it should be on focusing on the question of applicable law for contracts and dispute settlements. The questions, especially question four, I believe will create a lot of feedback that are opinion-based. It's an unscientific survey, and I think it's going to be a major distraction in dealing with it then. As a backdrop, on the jurisdiction mailing list, there's been talk about ICANN getting immunity. Perhaps there could be a treaty to address all this. I think these are legitimate questions. I just don't think the Workstream 2 is the appropriate forum for them. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And in fairness, I think that would be the right time to quote the comment we've received from Jorge Cancio, who was not able to attend this meeting, who was sort of playing with this same type of arguments, but coming to a different conclusion from a different input. So I think that's going to be in our second reading, a key aspect of our discussion, whether or not to go out and whether that's going to help the group actually focus on real cases, which is, I think, an interesting way forward. But until then, at least we have some refinements to give to the questions and have a second discussion. So thank you very much, David, for laying out your view on that. It's been quite split in the group, so it's important that the plenary is aware of this. Greg, would you like to add anything?
Yes, although not directly to that point, though I could speak on that at length. Rather, I'd like to ask staff to put up the second document, which is the poll that was conducted, and also to correct an incorrect statement in the chat. These questions are not being presented to the CCWG plenary as a package. They're being presented for individual consideration and approval and editing by the CCWG. So if we look at the poll, we'll see that in consideration of these questions, not all received equal support. So here we can see that the first three questions did all receive the same level of support, although not from exactly the same people, but that's not really important. In each case of the 31 who responded, 29 supported the questions as phrased, at least to put forward to the CCWG plenary, not to second-guess the CCWG plenary's decision. So we have the same support for questions 1, 2, and 3. So if we scroll down to the second page, you can see the last two questions. On question 4, we had something close to a split, with 17 answering the poll, responding that they supported putting this question forward, and 14 that did not support putting the question forward. So that raises the question of, you know, what is the necessary level of support to put something forward, you know, even to the plenary. So we're putting these forward, but it's important to note the level of support and of non-support from within the group with regard to these questions. I'll leave it to others to determine what the level of support is, but generally my understanding has been that decisions have been based on the rough consensus model. My personal view of how to determine rough levels of consensus would put this really at divergence, but noting there is a slight majority, 17 to 14. So one could also call that significant support, but strong opposition, or whatever that that next level is. So we need to, that it just needs to be duly noted that there was a significant difference of active opinion on whether this question 4 should be put forward. Lastly, a question was asked, if question 4 is not approved, I support sending out a questionnaire containing only questions 1 to 3. We did not ask the opposite question, which is, if question 4 is approved, I do not support sending out the questionnaire, period. So of those we did ask who answered this, and there were a couple of non-answers for this one, 4 to be exact. 19 supported sending out the questionnaire without question 4, and 8 did not support sending out the questionnaire without question 4. So that's a background to the questions being put forward and to the level of support for each of the questions in the
Okay, thanks, Greg. I think that's important to report as well. And I don't think we can go any further today. As a plenary, we've heard the various options and how the subgroup has been split on some of these options. Certainly, there's a first line of action for the subgroup, which is to refine, taking into account the comments we've heard on the questions themselves. And then I suggest we come back to the plenary for a second discussion about how to proceed, and this can be expanded on the full list as well as in the subgroup. In the meantime, we'll have a few weeks for that, considering the end-of-year break, for which where activity will be lower. Cavus, I'm sorry, but I'm conscious of time, and there are two other key discussions we're not going to conclude today in the first reading. So with your permission, I'd like to move to the next agenda item. Thank you for your understanding to the human rights discussion, and that's going to be chaired by Leon. Leon?
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Leon Sanchez. And on the human rights, we have had an amazing progress, I think. And we are now, we will now go through the first reading of the human rights report. And for that, I would like to handle the floor to Greg and Tatiana. And I think that Greg will begin, and Tatiana will continue with this first reading. So, Greg, could you please take the floor?
Sure. Thank you very much. And what we are now looking at is a first reading of the human rights subgroups framework of interpretation, which I am now. If we could put that up in the chat, that would be helpful. Do we have it available? Looks like perhaps we don't have it available, so let me with apologies, let me get it in front of me. I was so absorbed in the previous topic that I did not have the document in front of me.
We're managing with staff to see whether we can have the document on screen. Please bear with us for a moment.
Just want to make sure that I will read the appropriate document. As you can imagine, we had quite a number of drafts before the final, and I want to make sure that we have the right one in front of all of us. Maybe we should turn to transparency and come back to this, with all due respect. Tatiana is sending it to me. Being several hours ahead of me, having had at least one cup of coffee more than myself. Okay, I now have it here in front of me, so I will begin. We begin with a prelude. With ICANN's most recent bylaw change, a human rights core value was added to ICANN's bylaw. In order for this bylaw to come into effect, a framework of interpretation should be approved for submission to the board by the CCWG accountability as a consensus recommendation in Workstream 2. Actually, what I will do is skip the prelude in the interest of time. We can come back to that, but I think what's important is to begin the discussion of the actual framework itself. So let me do that and go to page 2 of this document. What we've done here is to basically take apart the bylaw into its phrases and provide interpretation for each phrase. So the first of those is within its scope and its mission. So within the scope of its mission, framework of interpretation, ICANN's mission is set forth in Section 1.1 of the ICANN bylaws, see Annex 1, where the appropriate section is set forth. The mission establishes the boundaries of ICANN's core value to respect human rights. due to the broad scope of human rights, attention to this limitation is necessary to ensure that ICANN will not step outside of its defined scope and mission. In this regard, any interpretation of the application of the human rights core value provided in the framework of interpretation must be checked against ICANN's mission to ensure compliance with the general limitations provided in this part of the bylaw. I'll pause there. I think we can actually go on to this very next one and then pause. Within the scope of other core values, it is important to stress that the human rights bylaw is a core value and not a commitment. Quote, the commitments reflect ICANN's fundamental compact with the global internet community and are intended to apply consistently and comprehensively to ICANN's activities, unquote, bylaws section 1.2c. In contrast, core values are not necessarily intended to apply consistently and comprehensively to ICANN's activities. Rather, the core values are subject to the following interpretive rules in the bylaws. Quote, the specific way in which core values are applied, individually and collectively, to any given situation may depend on many factors that cannot be fully anticipated or enumerated. Situations may arise, and with perfect fidelity to all core values simultaneously is not possible. Accordingly, in any situation where one core value must be balanced with another potentially competing core value, the result of the balancing must serve a policy developed through the bottom-up multi-stakeholder process or otherwise best serve ICANN's mission. Bylaws Section 1.2c. The human rights bylaw needs to be balanced against other core values in the case where not all core values can be fully adhered to simultaneously. Furthermore, this interpretive rule recognizes that there must be flexibility in applying the core values based on, quote-unquote, many factors that occur in, quote-unquote, any given situation. This is also made clear in the core values section of the bylaws, which states that the core values are intended to, quote, guide, quote, unquote, ICANN in its decisions and actions, quote, unquote. The bylaws also prominently stress that core values have to be, quote, unquote, respected. Quote, ICANN will act in a manner that complies with and reflects ICANN's commitments and respect ICANN's core values, unquote, as stipulated in bylaws section 1.2. Finally, there is no standing hierarchy in the treatment of the different core values. They are guiding elements that need, as appropriate, to be taken into account. The balance must be determined on a case-by-case basis, on the basis of proportionality, without automatically favoring any particular core value. The result of a balancing test must not cause ICANN to violate any commitments, as commitments are binding. The other core values are set forth in Annex 2 of this document. I'll pause here. And Tatiana will pick up if there are no comments or if you want us to go through.
Thank you very much, Greg. So I think that the reading has been quite clear. I'm not sure if anyone has any comments on what has been read so far. And if there are no comments, then I would turn to Tatiana to continue reading the document.
Thank you very much, Leon. Tatiana Tropina is speaking for the record, and thanks so much, Greg, for kicking this off. So I will move to the next subject of interpretation, which is the meaning of respecting. So we decided to put it like this. I start reading the interpretation. ICANN will respect human rights as required by applicable law. See below on applicable law. In order to do so, ICANN should avoid violating human rights and take human rights into account in developing its policies as well as its decision-making processes. That's all for respecting. The next part of the bylaw is internationally recognized human rights. Our interpretation is as follows. There are a range of international human rights declarations and covenants that could be relevant to ICANN's human rights core value. However, none of these instruments has a direct application to ICANN because they only create obligations for states. By committing to one or more of these international instruments, nation states are expected to embed human rights in their national legislation. The reference to internationally recognized human rights in the bylaw should not be read in isolation. Rather, it must be considered together with and limited by the reference as required by applicable law. As a consequence, under the human rights core value, international human rights instruments are not directly applicable to ICANN beyond what is provided for in applicable law. Rather, only those human rights that are required by applicable law will be relevant to ICANN. Furthermore, depending on the jurisdiction in which ICANN operates, the law applicable to its operations may vary, and thus the human rights applicable to ICANN's operations will vary as well. Nevertheless, ICANN understands that internationally recognized human rights, including those expressed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, can guide its decisions and actions. Thank you very much. We can see if there are any comments, and then I can pass Greg for one part, for the part of applicable law. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Sukena. So are there any comments or questions on what has been read so far? Okay, seeing none, I will turn back to Greg. Greg?
Thank you. For the final or next part, as required by applicable law. Applicable law refers to the body of law that binds ICANN at any given time, in any given circumstance, and in any relevant jurisdiction. It consists of statutes, rules, regulations, etc., as well as judicial terms. Perhaps if you could mute if you're not talking, or even if you are coughing. It is a dynamic concept inasmuch as laws, regulations, etc., change over time. Applicable law can have disparate impacts on ICANN around the globe. For example, if ICANN employs personnel in different jurisdictions, then it must observe the appropriate labor laws in those various locales. Applicable law is thus a large body of law that eludes our ability to catalog, but it is ascertainable in the context of a specific question or issue. This limitation requires an analysis to determine whether any human right that is proposed as a guide or limitation to ICANN's activities or policies is required by applicable law. If it is, then abiding by the core value should include a violation of that human right. If the human right is not required by applicable law, then it does not raise issues under the core value. However, ICANN may still give this human right consideration, even though it is under no guidance to do so pursuant to the core values. I'll pause here, turn back to Tatiana for the final two parts.
Thank you very much, Greg. So two final sentences, two final interpretation. The first one is this core value does not create and shall not be not be interpreted to create any obligation on ICANN outside its mission or beyond obligations found in applicable law. Our interpretation is as follows. This sentence restates the basic concept that the human rights core value cannot create or be used to create any obligations that go beyond the limits of ICANN's mission or applicable law. The last part is this core value does not obligate ICANN to enforce its human rights obligations or the human rights obligations of other parties against other parties. We interpret it as follows. This part of the bylaw draws the clear line between respect for human rights as a core value and any attempt to extend the bylaw into requiring ICANN to enforce the human rights obligations of ICANN or any other party against other parties. And then we have also Annex 1, which cites ICANN bylaw with regard to ICANN mission. And I think we have Annex 2, which cites ICANN by law with respect to other core values. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tatiana, and thanks to all who have worked so hard to get to this point on the framework of interpretation for the human rights bylaw. And if there are no comments at this point on what has been read, then I see David McCauley's hand is up. David?
Leon, thank you. It's David McCauley. I have just a clarification. And Greg, as you were reading under as required by applicable law, I think you may have dropped a word. So just in case I heard it wrong, if I'm correct, I'd like to just read that sentence again. I think you may have dropped the word avoiding. And so this is those two sentences where it says, and I'm quoting now, this limitation requires an analysis to determine whether any human right that is proposed as a guide or limitation to ICANN activities or policy is required by applicable law. If it is, then abiding by the core value should include avoiding a violation of that human right. It's possible, Greg, that you dropped the word avoiding. I'm not sure. Thank you.
Thank you, David. That would be an unfortunate word to leave out, kind of leaving out the word not in a sentence. But thank you.
Thanks, Greg. So I believe that we have gone through this document on the first reading, and if there are no objections at this point, I would like to conclude that the first reading of this document has been successful. And I see Kavus had this up, Kavus.
Yes, Leon, if there is no difficulty, sometimes it happens that because of no major modification, we could also approve it as a second reading. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavus. Your sound sounded a little bit muffled to me.
Okay.
So I guess
can I repeat? I said that
yes,
since there is no major modification, perhaps we could proceed with a second reading and approve it. Here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Kavus. That is a very nice suggestion. Although we have been clear throughout the whole process that no decision is made on a single call, and therefore I would advice that we respect our procedure as we have done throughout the whole process of the CCWG. And while I acknowledge that there are no objections and no major modifications to this document, that we hold the second reading on our next plenary call to stick to what we have been doing all along on the work of the CCWG. But thank you very much for your suggestion, Kavus. So having no other comments, I would now turn back to my co-chair, Thomas, for transparency.
Thanks very much, Leon. And we're now going to move to what's hopefully going to be another successful first reading. So let's discuss transparency. And you will remember that during our meeting in Hyderabad, we had Michael and his colleagues discuss the first, Michael and Chris in particular were at the top table to present the first version of the transparency report, which got a lot of positive feedback. However, there were a couple of points that the group asked to be revised. And 2 days back, Michael sent an updated version of the report to the list, and I've asked him to show the group through the structure of the report and maybe just highlight those points that were changed. Certainly with the document being 23 pages long, it is not possible to go through this document line by line, but even though I trust that everyone has taken a look at the document, I guess the discussion will benefit from a little introduction from Michael. So without any further ado, I'd like to hand over to Michael, please.
Hi, can you all hear me?
Yes, you can be heard all right.
Wonderful. So thanks very much for that introduction. Just to recap, we had a first sort of overview of the, we had an initial discussion of the first draft of this a little while back before Hyderabad, and then a very good substantive discussion in Hyderabad on the recommendations as they were at that point. We got a lot of feedback both in that session and on the sidelines of it from people, a lot of very useful stuff, which is great to have so many people engaging on that. And so as a result, we revised a few of the sections and are now presenting this revised version. Just to draw your attention to some of the major changes that have been done. First off the bat, the whistleblower protection sections and the section on interactions with governments are substantially the same as they were first presented. We did change the format of the document slightly, mostly in response to there were some concerns raised about mission creep and about the focus of this report expanding beyond what it was originally mandated to look at. And so in response to that, we decided to shift the categories around a little bit in order to stick more closely to the mission as originally conceived. So instead of a broader section on proactive disclosure, there are now more focused sections on interactions with governments and on transparency of board deliberations. The section on interactions with governments, as I mentioned, is the same. The section on transparency of board deliberations is all new. So I can start by drawing your attention to that, since that's obviously a major substantive addition. We got a lot of feedback about that as part of the conversation in terms of in Hyderabad, but not including some substantive areas that wanted to be looked at. And so we sort of tried to process that into concrete recommendations as well as a discussion of how transparency should be understood in terms of the board deliberations. Essentially looking at the structure, the main recommendation concerned the ability of board members to exclude information from the recorded and published minutes without any sort of process or oversight or even a need to ground it to a legitimate harm. Like, it was almost a discretionary decision. So there's a recommendation in there that says that the DIDP, where material is removed from the minutes of board meetings, it should only be removed where it would be subject to a DIDP exception. So basically, we want to make sure that decisions to remove information from board minutes are grounded to those exceptions in the DIDP, which should be a comprehensive list of reasons for non-disclosure. The first of all, we want to find something substantive to ground those decisions in. And second of all, we wanted to make sure that decisions to remove minutes from the board meetings could be subject to an IRP appeal. There's another recommendation, which is that where material is removed from the minutes of board meetings, the default should be to allow for its release after a particular period of time. And this is something that you see in most progressive access to information systems, is that rather than just blanketly saying this material is not available, you build in an exception to say, all right, it would be harmful to a particular interest of the organization to release it now. But we're going to include a provision that says this is going to be released in a year, in 5 years, in 10 years, whenever that harm from disclosure will have dissipated. So the idea is to push towards delaying release of information as vastly preferable to refusing release of information. The final recommendation on transparency of board deliberations is to clarify the DIDP exception for deliberative processes, which is to say that they shouldn't apply to factual information, technical reports, or reports on the performance or effectiveness of a particular body or strategy, and as well as any guidelines for or reasons for a decision which has already been taken or where the material has already been disclosed to a third party. And that's basically drawn from the way that access to information interpretations are parallel exceptions are interpreted in jurisdictions that have strong rules on this stuff, like India and the U.S. There's a fair amount of background discussion of that in the section itself, which I'm not going to sort of read out, but I would advise you guys to check out and engage with, particularly because there's a lot of interesting discussion there sort of justifying why that position is appropriate. In terms of the changes to the DIDP recommendations, again, it is a 22-page report, but if you want to find sort of the meat of what has changed or what we're really saying, the recommendations are only 2 or 3 pages, but I think fairly easy to engage with. There's a procedural additions, namely, in basically just in order to make the system work more effectively. We include a mention of the need to sort of centralize processing of responses to access to information requests. This came directly out of the discussions in Hyderabad, where, you know, people expressed some confusion about how their processes are being handled. And so it would be good for ICANN to sort of have either one staff member or a team of staff members whose defined role is to respond to DIDP requests as opposed to handling them on an ad hoc basis. And that information should be released publicly so people have an understanding of what they're going to be dealing with. We recommended, an additional recommendation is also to trend towards severability rather than refusal. And what that means is that basically where a particular document is requested and there's a couple of sentences within that document that make it fall foul of the exceptions to disclosure, rather than refusing disclosure, the default position should be to black out those sentences, redact those sentences, and release the rest of the document. And this is, again, what's done in better practice jurisdictions around the world, and I assume wouldn't be particularly controversial. Again, stemming from the discussions in Hyderabad, we included some discussion of open contracting, and the language on that and the recommendations is currently to say that ICANN should consider adopting open contracting, whereby all contracts over $5,000 are automatically disclosed, and non-disclosure clauses are limited in their application to the limited exceptions found in the DIDP. Now, that's something that would not apply retroactively because once non-disclosure agreements have been signed, I think it's fair to expect ICANN to adhere to them, but that's basically trying to push towards open contracting. And it was mentioned in the list that this might interact with some of the other processes around procurement that are currently ongoing. So we're sort of open to those discussions. This is less of a hard and fast. I mean, the language on this recommendation is a little bit looser for that reason because it does interact with other processes. There's also an exception for narrowing the scope of attorney-client privilege as interpreted by ICANN. That's something that sort of came up. It's come up a lot in commentary and feedback that we've got back, which is concern about the overclassification and the lack of understanding about the role of ICANN Legal. But I raised this in ICANN Legal session in Hyderabad, and they mentioned that they would be open to it. So I included a recommendation that says the DIDP exception for attorney-client privilege should be narrowed, so information will only be withheld if its disclosure would be harmful to an ongoing or contemplated lawsuit or negotiation, and explicitly disclosure of broader policy-making advice received from lawyers. Now, again, this is in line with what some states have been moving towards. We'll see whether ICANN finds that acceptable. It is worth noting that attorney-client privilege is always waived at the discretion of the client, and in this case, the client being ICANN. ICANN has the discretion to release any information subject to attorney-client privilege. It's just a question of whether they would be okay with narrowing it, but I wanted to include that because it had been raised previously and to see what the reaction would be, and hopefully they'll be amenable to it because it's something that a lot of people have raised concerns about. Finally, I think that those are the main changes that have been made. Nothing else is sort of jumping out at me. I will also mention that we got a little bit of feedback on the lists yesterday from Christopher Wilkinson, who mentioned a couple of issues. I don't think he's on the call today, but certainly we've received those issues and are processing them. He was the one that raised the thing about the procurement policy. I can clarify, though, now that when I talk about ICANN, in terms of the scope of the policy, at least my end, we haven't really had a broad conversation about who exactly this applies to and where ICANN sort of begins and ends. My personal understanding of it had kind of been that we were only looking at staff and the board, but that's certainly a conversation that needs to be had. I, again, personally don't necessarily see this applying all the way out to the empowered community, because again, it sort of raises questions in my mind about where does this end then? For me as a rapporteur, does this mean that my personal computer, which I've been doing this work on, is subject to these requests? I mean, that seems a bit of a stretch because I'm not really staff, but I'd be open to discussion on that. Finally, he mentioned a question about the cost of implementation, which I personally wouldn't. I'm not sure that that's necessarily our position as the working group to start discussing budgets. I don't think that the recommendations that we're making here are particularly expensive or costly to implement. But ultimately, that's something that I think would be beyond our skill set and mandate to be looking at. But again, open to discussion on that. So that's sort of an introduction on the changes that have been made. I'm trying to be as brief as possible. I think it would be really helpful to open it up for some discussion now and to see what people's thoughts are on the updated draft.
Thanks very much, Michael. And that exactly is the idea. There is a queue forming. And just before we delve into the questions and answers, we have published on the agenda that this is the first reading of the report. As you know, we're usually doing two readings, and I think that the quality of the document is such that allows for a first reading, despite the questions that Christopher Wilson has asked on the list, and maybe more questions that more people from this group will ask. So in terms of process, my suggestion would be that unless something really severe, let's say, turns up that begs the revision of the entire document, which I don't anticipate, we should maybe proceed with the first reading, work on the questions that were posed and that are going to be posed between today and the second reading. We're going to have a second, potentially slightly revised version of the document that can then be put out for the second reading. So that's just in terms of process and how we envisage to conduct this. And let's now move to Kavut, who is the first in line.
Thanks. I have just one clarification to seek relating to removing materials or text from the board minutes or minutes of the board. I need this clarification that usually the minutes, when they are drafted, would be subject to review by the board to confirm that what they have said, they finally agree with that. Are you talking before approval by the board, removing something, or after approval of the board? However, the board is free to remove anything when they approve the final draft. So we should give this clarity to this possibility to them, because sometimes when you read that, you see that, yes, they may not be correct, and you have to correct that. So just a clarification. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kavus. Greg is next.
Thanks. Greg Shatton for the record. As much as I'm an advocate for transparency, I am concerned about the idea and possible unintended consequences of a prospective waiver of attorney-client privilege, at least in certain circumstances. And I'm not even sure exactly, whether that, the waiver can be done quite so neatly. I think that this may require further investigation. Essentially, what's being proposed is rather than a case-by-case decision to waive under all but certain circumstances, it seems to be phrased, and maybe I've heard this incorrectly, as a blanket prospective waiver of a in certain circumstances that are narrower than those that are afforded under the applicable laws and regulations. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Greg. And just for those who might wonder why I did not move straight back to Michael, let's collect the comments, and I guess that your comments as well as the questions on list will need to be taken into account by Michael, Chris, and the whole team subsequently and potentially lead to an updated version of the document. So let's move to David now.
Thomas, thank you. It's David McCauley for the transcript. And you just got to the point that I was going to ask. If I'm not mistaken, Michael, this draft has not yet been discussed by the transparency subgroup. At least I don't believe it has. And to be frank, I haven't read it yet. I thought I was prepared to read it before our meeting on Friday, but I haven't read it yet. And so I was just concerned with us at the plenary level going through a first reading when the subgroup has not yet, if I'm correct, has not yet addressed this draft. And a good example of some things we could raise are the question that you, Michael, and Steve Del Bianco have noted in chat, that is about whether IRP is an appropriate level of challenging a redaction issue. It's a process question. I may be mistaken, but I don't believe that the sub-team has addressed this draft. Thank you.
Thanks very much, David. And I think that the sub-team certainly needs to take a look at the document and comment on it. So I have to confess I thought that this version of the document had been looked at by the sub-team. So let's try to get more comment on this. I had started this conversation by saying that I think we can proceed to the first reading and do necessary revisions between the first and the second reading. Now that you put this point out, David, let's hear views whether we can stick to that idea in terms of process, or whether you as a group wish to defer the first reading until such time when the sub-team has been able to fully digest and review. So I don't see any hands up, interestingly. Is there anyone who wants to speak to this point?
Thomas Cheryl here.
Cheryl, please.
I did put in chat, and for some reason the Adobe's gone flaky and my raised hand isn't being raised. I think it's far too soon for it to be a first reading here. Yes, it is a fulsome and well-structured document, but pre-Hyderabad, we had, as a sub-team, not gone through the minutiae, the details that we needed to, and with these additional changes post-Hyderabad, which are good and will probably be easy to discuss and make minor adjustments if needs be, but it has to go to the subgroup, otherwise it sort of doesn't, I don't believe it could come to the plenary as a first reading just yet. Soon, but not just yet.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. I see Chris's hand is up, and Chris, I'm not sure how you and Michael want to split this, but a couple of comments and concerns have been voiced in this discussion by Cavus and Greg. So in your intervention, you might also wish to respond to those. Please, Chris.
Thanks, Thomas. And I'll speak simply to the process questions, and I'll let Michael speak to those other questions that were raised. Just real quick, I agree that the subgroup hasn't had a lot of time to pore over the revised draft. Michael circulated it to the subgroup on Friday. Obviously, some of us on the subgroup, myself included, were at the IGF or on en route from IGF that day. And obviously, here we are. It's Wednesday, only a few days beyond that. So the expectation was not to cut out the subgroup from discussion of this revised draft. I think just for timing reasons, we had the plenary scheduled today. We have the subgroup call scheduled for tomorrow, I believe, and expect, if not tomorrow, on Friday, but this week, and then we'll have further discussion. I think, Thomas, to your point, the thought was that obviously unless there was major substantive concerns that it may make sense to proceed with the first reading, but obviously we're not beholden to that. If we want to move again, that's fine. That's fine. But just want to make sure folks were aware that we were not trying to cut out the subgroup in any way, shape, or form. I think it just simply was that the timing sort of jived this way. So we look forward to further subgroup consideration via the list and also on our call this week. So I just wanted to make sure folks were aware of that. So that's it for me. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Chris. And you mentioned the right word now, timing. And since we only have 2 minutes left on this call, I would suggest that we do not call this for the first reading, but that we actually do two things. One is that the subteam discusses this paper during its upcoming call, so that we hopefully get a consolidated version from the subteam for the next plenary. And secondly, we will invite colleagues of the CCWD plenary to take a look at this very document and raise their questions and concerns and comments on the list so that you and your team can hopefully take those into account when preparing an update to this document. And that would specifically include the questions or responses or comments on the questions raised by Christopher Wilkinson, Cavus, whose question remains unanswered for today, but you'll get back to that in writing, and also the point made by Greg on the client attorney privilege. So with that, I would like to thank you for preparing this document. We will bring it up during the next plenary call again. And now I'd like to hand over to Mathieu for the remaining part of the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. This is going to be simple and short. Are there any other business? Cavus.
Yes, in fact, it is not other business. We have mentioned in the chat many people, and we have to formally, perhaps you as a co-chair or both of you or three of you, expressing our sincere appreciation to Neil for the tremendous amount of work he has done, for the hard work, for the skill, for patience, and for his democracy. He listened to everybody and perhaps he should give some greeting to other coaches to be as kind as he with everybody. He never got any point than being totally a neutral coacher and pushing forward for work to have a finished defeat. It was very, very difficult. So perhaps you may express your thanks to him formally to be recorded in the session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. And indeed, I think this appreciation for Niels as the rapporteur, as well as the drafting team, has been put on the record already in the notes. And that's well deserved. And indeed, it's only a start, since the work is also continuing on other aspects. So I'm looking forward to the next steps. So having no other business, and since we've reached the top of the hour, It's going to be time to close this meeting. We've had very substantive discussion. It demonstrates that several subgroups, actually almost all the subgroups, are making great progress. And I'm looking forward to the first meetings we will have in 2017. They will be very interesting. Looking forward to continuing this effort with all of you. And for those of you who are taking a break for the end of year, enjoy the break, come back refreshed, and we are going to have exciting new adventures in 2017. Thank you, everyone, and the meeting is now adjourned. We may stop the recording.